content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the November 14th, 2025 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week is the scene of a typical late-night talk show. It's the Tucker Carlson show. He is sitting at his desk, and he's laughing loudly. His first guest is, I gather, Nick Fuentes in a Nazi uniform. He's also smiling and gesturing with his hands. And the second guest, who I'm not sure who it is in a KKK suit. The headline is Mainstreaming Hate, Carlson Anti-Semitism, and the Fight for the GOP's Future. We get that story on the Controversy of the Week. We'll start with the first main story and how they were covered. Democrats ride anti-Trump wave to victory. What happened? Democrats this week swept an off-year election day with a series of commanding wins from Virginia to California, delivering a rebuke of President Trump and raising the party's hopes for the 2026 midterms. In New Jersey, a closely fought gubernatorial contest turned into a 13-point rout by Representative Mikey Sherrill, a former Navy helicopter pilot who cast Republican Jack Ciattarelli as a MAGA acolyte who would do whatever Trump tells him to do. Sherrill won at least five counties Trump carried in 2024. In Virginia, former Congresswoman and ex-CIA officer Abigail Spanberger will succeed GOP Governor Glenn Youngkin after crushing Republican Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earl Sears by 15 points. Running as a pragmatic centrist, Spanberger produced a blue shift in every county from the 2021 gubernatorial election. "Tonight we sent a message," she said at her victory party. "Virginians chose Commonwealth over chaos." In a victory for California Governor Gavin Newsom, state voters overwhelmingly approved Proposition 50, a ballot measure he promoted as a pushback against Republican gerrymandering in Texas and elsewhere. It will allow the state legislature to redraw congressional maps, yielding up to five new Democratic seats. In a closely watched election, voters in swing state Pennsylvania retained three Democratic justices on the state Supreme Court, preserving a Democratic majority, while in New York City, Democratic Socialist Zoran Mandami trounced Trump's preferred candidate, Independent Andrew Cuomo. "What a night for the Democratic Party," said Newsom, "a party that is in its ascendancy, a party that's on its toes, no longer on its heels." In a social media post, Trump blamed Republicans' poor showing on the government shutdown and one other factor: Trump wasn't on the ballot. What the columnist said. "What a turnaround," said Ed Kilgore in New York. "When Republicans took the White House in Congress last November, it was heralded as the beginning of a realignment, and Democrats fell into recriminations and despair. But this week, they romped in almost every competitive venue. They stopped a GOP ballot initiative to rig voting rules in Maine and flipped two seats on Georgia's Public Service Commission, which hasn't held a Democrat since 2007. In Virginia, Democrats flipped 13 seats in the state House, and Jay Jones, their candidate for attorney general, beset by a text messaging scandal involving violent fantasies about Republicans, won anyway. The top races delivered a lesson for Democrats," said Domenico Montanaro in NPR.org. "It's the cost of living, stupid." Sherrill, Spanberger, and Mamdani all focused on kitchen table issues. And in exit polls, voters in New York, Virginia, and California listed the economy as their top concern. That's a very bad sign for Republicans and Trump, who clearly now owns the economy, no matter how much he tries to blame former President Joe Biden. The election results shouldn't be overinterpreted, said National Review in an editorial. Republicans typically face a tough road in Virginia and New Jersey, and especially so in off-year elections when the GOP holds power in Washington. Still, the routes bode badly for next year's midterms. So does a shift among Latino voters, who swung hard for Trump in 2024, said Sarah Dorn in Forbes. They overwhelmingly broke Democratic in the gubernatorial races, backing Spanberger and Sherrill by 2-to-1 margins. Don't ignore the election's key takeaways, said Michael Tomasky in The New Republic. Most Americans hate Trump and what he's doing to this country. The president and his allies live in a fanatical bubble where his polls are great, and we're skipping through an American renaissance. In the real world, his disapproval rating just hit 63%. Food prices remain high, and Americans don't seem to want the federal workforce decimated, the White House bulldozed, or masked quasi-vigilantes rounding up brown people. For Democrats, the election results point to a looming intra-party battle, said Lisa Lehrer in the New York Times. Will they fare better as a centrist party built on candidates like Sherrill and Spanberger, who focused on attacking Trump rather than offering bold new ideas? Or is it Mamdani's populist vision and critiques of unfettered capitalism that point the way forward? As they try to rebuild their damaged brand, the Democrats remain a party teeming with tensions over age, ideology, tactics, and tone. But for now, at least, they've showed they can pull off the most important goal in politics. They can win, and win big. And the controversy of the week, as referenced in the cover drawing, the GOP, will it welcome anti-Semites? The poison of anti-Semitism is growing on the new right, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, and it's spreading wider and faster than we thought. Last week, Tucker Carlson hosted Hitler fanboy Nick Fuentes on his podcast for a chummy two-hour interview watched by more than 5 million people. The white nationalist influencer, 27, toned down his material for the chat. He's previously talked about wanting a child bride and fantasized about killing a black man with Hitler, but still praised Soviet tyrant Joseph Stalin and assailed the threat of organized Jewry. Carlson largely nodded along and even admitted he loathed Christian Zionists, such as the staunchly pro-Israel GOP Senator Ted Cruz, more than anybody. That Carlson would grant Fuentes access to his massive audience is proof that his hate is entering the MAGA mainstream, said Ollie Breland in The Atlantic. Look at the recently leaked group chats of young Republican leaders, which were full of the kind of anti-Semitic and racist jokes beloved by Fuentes and his legion of young fans, known as Groypers. Conservative writer Rod Dreher, a friend of Vice President J.D. Vance, says he's been told that 30-40% of Republican staffers in Washington under age 30 are Groypers. Fuentes said in 2021 that his goal was to turn the GOP into a truly reactionary party. That vision is coming true. Conservatives who detest anti-Semitism were shaken by the interview, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. But they were even more alarmed when Kevin Roberts, head of the Heritage Foundation, the GOP's preeminent think tank, released a video defending Carlson's decision to host Fuentes. He said Heritage doesn't police the consciences of Christians and accused a venomous coalition of targeting Carlson. It's an argument made by other prominent New Right thinkers who portray the left as an existential threat that necessitates the final loosening of all remaining restraints. Roberts did eventually denounce Fuentes after some Heritage donors and staffers slammed his video, but it was too late to stop a MAGA civil war, said Will Sommer in The Bulwark. Podcaster Ben Shapiro attacked Carlson for normalizing Nazism. Cruz called Carlson a coward. And Representative Randy Fine, the Republican from Florida, said he'd canceled an event with Heritage because I don't work with anti-Semites. Yet the silence from President Trump's heir apparent was deafening, said Eli Lake in the Free Press. Vice President J.D. Vance, a Carlson ally, said nothing about Fuentes, despite being a repeat target of Fuentes' bio. In recent live streams, Fuentes has called Vance, whose wife Usha is Indian American, a fat race mixer, and vowed to disrupt Vance's likely 2008 presidential campaign if he gets too close to the Israel First lobby. Vance has gone out of his way to avoid offending Groypers, chiding the pearl clutchers who were outraged by the Young Republicans' chat. Perhaps Vance thinks he can tame the feral Groypers, retain his friendship with Carlson, and keep the MAGA peace. But this is delusional. It's not, if you remember, never Trumpism, circa 2016, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. Back then, plenty of Republicans, like Vance, denounced Trump as an unfit degenerate, only to embrace him as the specter of a Hillary Clinton presidency loomed. So why wouldn't they embrace a future candidate who's friendly to Fuentes, or at least one who can triangulate the growing divide between anti-Semitic and anti-anti-Semitic Republicans? Practicing strategic silence might just be enough for Vance to keep everyone on side. There will be no right-wing crack-up. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for distancing. After President Trump claimed in a 60 Minutes interview that he had no idea who Xi Jinping Zhao is, despite having pardoned the cryptocurrency billionaire of enabling money laundering just days earlier. Zhao's firm, Binance, has had business dealings with the Trump family's crypto company, World Liberty Financial. It's a good week for emergency rations after a 77-year-old Frenchman fell into a 130-foot-deep ravine while cycling home from a market in the mountainous region of Chavannes. He was rescued 3 days later, having sustained himself on several bottles of red wine that mercifully survived the fall. It was a good week for Fido 2.0 after Tom Brady revealed that his young pit bull mix, Junie, is actually a clone of Lua, a family pet who died 2 years ago. The ex-NFL star thanked Colossal Biosciences, which specializes in species restoration, for giving his family a second chance with our beloved dog. It was a bad week for melting pots after Vice President J.D. Vance told an interviewer that he finds it totally reasonable and acceptable for Americans not to want to live next to neighbors who don't speak English. Vance's sympathy deepens further if the hypothetical neighbors are from a totally different culture. It's a bad week for Los Angeles, which has displaced Chicago as the nation's most rat-infested city, according to Orkin. The pest control company cited several factors that helped L.A. claim the number one spot on its rattiest cities list, including year-round warm weather and a booming culinary scene. Finally, it was a bad week for diagnoses. After a Maine Health Service sent letters to 531 still-living patients expressing condolences for their deaths and advising how next of kin could settle their estates. One patient who called Maine Health about the erroneous letter said a customer service rep told her, "I'm glad to hear that you're still alive and well." And I'm like, "Yeah, me too." On to the briefing, title this week, Ultra-Processed America. Highly processed foods make up most of our diet. Is that so bad? What are ultra-processed foods? It's a bit of a fuzzy area, but the gist is they're refined foods made from ingredients not typically found in home kitchens. Brazilian researcher Carlos Augusto Monteiro popularized the term in 2009 when he classified food into four categories. At one end of the spectrum lies foods from the farm, such as vegetables, fruits, milk, eggs, and meat. At the other, ultra-processed foods, including sodas and energy drinks, one-box meals, junk foods like chips and fast food. The addition of high-fructose corn syrup is usually a hint that a food is ultra-processed. Eating these products has been linked to diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, depression, and obesity. Given that nearly one-third of teenagers and almost half of adults are pre-diabetic or diabetic, ultra-processed foods have become a scapegoat for America's health problems. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. called them a poison that's driving our chronic disease epidemic. And California just became the first state to regulate them. But public health experts disagree on the dangers they pose, with some arguing the category is meaningless because it can describe everything from corn dogs to canned black beans. A whole lot of things that you could never imagine can be done to food, said the University of North Carolina nutritionist Barry Popkin. You can't tell simply by the ingredients. How much of these foods do we eat? About 70% of the U.S. food supply qualifies as ultra-processed. And these items made up 55% of the food Americans ate from 2021 to 2023, according to a new Centers for Disease Control report. They've been omnipresent in grocery stores for decades, with high-fructose corn syrup consumption increasing 100-fold from 1970 to 1993. But Americans are actually eating less of these foods than in previous years. The mean percentage of calories consumed by adults from ultra-processed foods dropped 3 percentage points from 2018 to 2023, sinking to 53%. For kids and teens, it dropped by almost 4 points to 61.9%. While the bulk of most people's calories still comes from ultra-processed foods, statistically the decline is significant, said the CDC's Ann Williams. Are they unhealthy? The most prominent study by the National Institutes of Health compared an unprocessed diet loaded with fresh fruits and vegetables with an ultra-processed diet, giving participants in both groups equal amounts of salt, sugar, and fiber. The people on the junkie diet ate about 500 more calories a day and gained more weight. Energy density, or calories per gram of food, explained the difference. Ultra-processed food is nearly twice as fattening as fresh food. 3 cups of broccoli, for example, has 100 calories, the same amount as half a Hershey bar. A 2025 study also found a person's risk of premature death rose almost 3% for every 10% increase in ultra-processed foods consumed. No reason exists to believe that humans can fully adapt to these products, said Monteiro. So why do we eat them? partly because they taste great. Ultra-processed foods are addictive, echoing the effect of a hit of nicotine on our dopamine systems. Studies show eliminating them can lead to withdrawal symptoms such as anxiety. They're also cheap and easy. In the NIH study, the unprocessed meals cost 40% more and took longer to prepare. That's why ultra-processed TV dinners became popular in the 1950s and 60s, when more women were working but were still tasked with feeding their families. Nearly 19 million Americans now live in food deserts without access to healthy food and with little leisure time. You have to be like, what am I going to cook? What am I shopping for? Said health policy expert Julia Wolfson. It's a lot of planning and cognitive functioning and mental energy, which is not time or cost neutral. How are these foods regulated? Under California's new bipartisan Real Food Healthy Kids Act, the state will identify ultra-processed foods of concern and eliminate them from school lunches by 2035. The ban is expected to cover most foods that contain unnatural substances like emulsifiers and flavor enhancers, as well as those with high levels of saturated fat, added sugar, sodium, and certain sweeteners. D.C. politicians can talk all day about making America healthy again, but we've been walking the walk, said Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom. On this issue, he's aligned with Kennedy and his MAHA movement. Kennedy plans to release updated nutritional guidance prioritizing whole foods, healthy foods, and local foods in pinning down the definition of ultra-processed. Will that help? It's debatable. Some experts argue the ultra-processed foods category is too broad to regulate. It contains Doritos and Coke, but also store-bought whole wheat bread and hummus. Some highly processed products, such as certain breakfast cereals and yogurts, aren't associated with poor health outcomes. Others, like gluten-free bread, provide alternatives for people with allergies. A committee advising the federal government last year decided against taking a strong position on ultra-processed foods, saying the science just wasn't sufficient to reach a definitive conclusion. There are probably some subcategories that are perfectly fine, maybe even really good for you, and others that are particularly damaging, said NIH researcher Kevin Hall. I just don't think we know which ones. The corn syrup boom. It's no accident that corn syrup is so prominent in our diet. Subsidies given to farmers in the early 1980s made corn syrup production incredibly profitable, just as tariffs raised the price of imported sugar. High fructose corn syrup was a much cheaper ingredient than domestic sugar, and bread and snack companies made the switch. It's a different story in Europe, where the use of corn syrup is discouraged. Products like Fanta orange soda or Heinz ketchup, which have corn syrup here, contain sugar over there. But we may be slowly inching closer to Europe's model. Coca-Cola, which swapped cane sugar for high fructose corn syrup in 1984, announced plans to reverse that move this year, one of numerous companies to make the switch. But as with corn syrup, excess consumption of cane sugar can lead to weight gain and other health problems. These one ingredient changes, said nutritionist and food policy expert Marion Nestle, don't make those foods healthy. Time for a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. Reviving a food stamp stereotype. as millions of food stamp recipients face real hunger, the myth of the welfare queen has come roaring back to life, said Chrissy Clark. Popularized by Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, this mythical figure was based on a very old set of tropes and stereotypes about shiftless black women who refused to work to keep the welfare spigot turned on. Now that Republicans and President Trump are holding SNAP or food stamp benefits for 42 million Americans hostage in the government shutdown battle, their supporters are posting phony AI-generated videos of female SNAP recipients boasting of using their benefits to buy steaks and luxury items. One Trump ally, lawyer Mike Davis, posted on X that food stamp recipients should get off your fat ghetto asses. But this is not an accurate depiction of most food stamp recipients. Two-thirds are over 60, children or teens, or people with disabilities. The vast majority of the other third work, but get paid so poorly they still qualify for food assistance. More recipients are white than any other race, and undocumented immigrants don't qualify. And the average food stamp benefit is $6 a day. Could you live like a queen on that? The economic costs of zero migration. For the first time in nearly a century, said Idris Kaloun, the U.S. will soon hit net zero migration, with fewer foreign-born people entering the country than leaving. The Trump administration has triumphantly predicted that net zero will be achieved this year as a result of deportations, border controls, and extreme restrictions on work and student visas. The consequences will include a shrinking population, fewer workers to pay for retired Americans' benefits, and lower economic growth. We know this because the U.S. has tried it before. Previous immigration crackdowns in the 1930s and the 60s and the early 2000s, paradoxically, did not produce more jobs or higher wages for native-born workers. Why? Deprived of cheap, low-skilled labor, employers often turn to automation or offshoring rather than increase their payroll costs. Many entrepreneurs, meanwhile, are deterred from launching new businesses. If the U.S. remains net zero, our country's population will actually decline because our birth rate is so low. Payments into Social Security and Medicare will decline, accelerating the day the welfare state runs out of money. If Americans' gates are all but pulled shut for years, American citizens will feel serious pain. This column comes from Mexico. The plague smuggled into our country. Mexico eradicated the devastating New World screwworm decades ago, said Luis Hernandez Navarro, but the parasite is now returning with a vengeance. The screwworm is a parasitic fly whose larvae burrow into animals' flesh, causing fatal infections. Smugglers have brought it across our southern border via the 800,000 head of cattle that are illegally imported each year, mostly from Nicaragua. How is it that over 2,000 animals a day, some of them infected with screwworm, can enter Mexican territory without any authority noticing? The answer is they do notice. They just don't care. An operation this big can't function without the complicity and impunity of crooked health inspectors, police, soldiers, politicians, truckers, and ranchers. Like skilled magicians, black marketeers transform illegal cattle into legal ones with reused or counterfeit identification tags, which officially cost 50 pesos, $2.70, but fetch 10 times that on the black market. The criminals and their accomplices in government don't care whether the animals are healthy or sick. Now the U.S., which buys 80% of our beef, has begun blocking Mexican beef to protect its own herds. Our government is releasing sterile screwworm flies in an effort to eradicate the disease. But that's not enough. if it continues turning a blind eye to smuggling, our beef industry will collapse. The last word, our feature article. What happened to the Tea Party? The anti-tax small government uprising redefined Republican politics, said Naftali Ben David in the Washington Post. But in the MAGA era, there's no room for such a movement in the GOP. The movement tore across the country with an energy new to American politics, its activists shouting at lawmakers and holding frenzied rallies to demand balanced budgets, to end deficit spending, sharp tax cuts, fealty to Constitution, and a reined-in presidency. This was the Tea Party movement, which punctuated its arrival 15 years ago with the midterm elections of 2010, a moment that seemed poised to rewrite the rules of American politics. Yet just a few years later, the Republican Party was captured by the MAGA movement and President Donald Trump, whose agenda, to some Tea Party pioneers, is the opposite of theirs and which dominates the party today. We feared government tyranny. We feared a strong executive. We feared oppressive government. Any president who would take a flamethrower to the Constitution, said former Congressman Joe Walsh of Illinois, a Tea Party Republican who has since become a podcaster and anti-Trump Democrat. Now the very thing we feared is in office. The current spending fight reflects the dizzying shift. The Tea Party's core demand was fiscal responsibility. But Trump's signature spending bill adds $3.4 trillion to the deficit, according to the Congressional Budget Office, and passed with overwhelming GOP support. In the current dispute over the government shutdown, Republicans are pushing not for cuts, but for an extension of Biden-era spending levels. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, a rare Republican who opposes his party's spending measures, said the Tea Party spirit has evaporated. I think it's largely been supplanted by something else, Paul said in an interview. We aren't organized around ideas anymore. We're organized around a person. A number of people who were Tea Party stars in 2010, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem, Transportation Secretary Sean P. Duffy, are firmly ensconced in Trump's cabinet. And some Republicans insist that the MAGA movement is a successor to the Tea Party, not a rejection of it, arguing that both tout free markets and individual freedom. I think MAGA is an extension of the Tea Party movement in many ways, and also its own thing, because we'll never see anyone like President Trump again in our lifetime, said Jenny Beth Martin, who co-founded the Tea Party Patriots in 2009. The similarity is that both movements love our country and want what's best for our country. Yet many Trump policies appear to contradict Tea Party ideals. The Tea Party abhorred taxes. Trump has imposed high taxes on imports with his tariffs. The Tea Party revered the Constitution. Trump routinely tests its limits, for example, by seizing power over spending and tariffs. The Tea Party championed the rule of law. Trump openly targets his opponents using the legal system. More fundamentally, the Tea Party, driven by anger at President Barack Obama, called for a modest presidency to allow homegrown democracy to flourish. Trump is a dominant, attention-seeking leader who brooks no opposition and regularly pushes to expand his power. No political party has moved so quickly from don't tread on me to do tread on me than the GOP and its transition from a Tea Party-inspired party to a MAGA-incorporated-inspired party. Former Republican Congressman Justin Amash of Michigan posted recently on X. Amash, like Walsh and Paul, was elected to Congress in the 2010 Tea Party wave. The Tea Party and MAGA movements are linked by at least one striking quality: a fury at liberal elites who, they contend, have coddled unworthy groups at the expense of ordinary, hardworking Americans. That is evident from the two seminal moments that launched these political tidal waves. On February 19, 2009, 1 month after Obama took office, CNBC correspondent Rick Santelli delivered what his fans affectionately called a rant on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. On air, Santelli slammed Obama's plan to bail out homeowners who'd fallen behind on their mortgages, calling them losers for buying houses they could not afford. Santelli's rant resonated as a broader cry against the unfairness of the American system. "President Obama, are you listening?" he demanded during his tirade. "We're thinking of having a Chicago Tea Party in July. All you capitalists that want to show up to Lake Michigan, I'm going to start organizing." Almost 50 Tea Party groups immediately sprang up and held protest against Obama's stimulus bill, which was a response to the 2008 financial meltdown. On April 15th, tax day, more than 850 groups held demonstrations that organizers said drew 1.2 million people. On election day, this fervor propelled Republicans to an astounding pickup of 63 House seats and 6 Senate seats. "We felt like we were the conscience of the Republican Party," Walsh said, "of coming to the U.S. Capitol in those exciting days. You felt like you were conquering the Republican Party." 6 years later, when Trump announced his run for president, he echoed Santelli's fiery message that honest Americans were getting cheated. But crucially, Trump insisted that he alone was the answer to the nation's problems, a self-aggrandizement foreign to the Tea Party. "Our country needs a truly great leader, and we need a truly great leader now. We need a leader that wrote The Art of the Deal," Trump said, referring to his book. "I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created." Former GOP Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Beutler of Washington, who was elected to the House in 2010 but never considered herself part of the Tea Party movement, sees a crucial difference between the two groups. Tea Party activists wanted to shrink the government and looked to the Constitution for inspiration, she said. While MAGA's adherents largely had given up on the Constitution and simply want to seize the government for their own ends. "A lot of people now are feeling that their problems are not going to be solved by a constitutional government, the way the Tea Party did," Herrera Beutler said. "The Tea Party thought we should get government out of our lives. That is not the ethos being talked about right now. Now it's like, the government doesn't work. We need to take control and fix things." As a result, Republicans accept things that would have appalled them in the Obama years, she added, like Trump's intervention in spending decisions. "Nobody is saying anything about it," Herrera Beutler said. "If that had happened when Republicans took over under the Tea Party involvement, if Obama had done that, people would have been up in arms about the damage being done to the Constitution." The Tea Party arose at a time when the GOP was arguably in worse shape than Democrats today. Obama had just won a decisive victory, generating enormous enthusiasm as the nation's first black president. And Democrats held overwhelming majorities of 257 to 178 in the House and 60 to 40 in the Senate. The new movement provided a storyline when conservatives needed it most. Obama and the Democrats were betraying America's founding ideals, and it was time to restore the founders' small government dreams. Demonstrators hoisted Don't Tread on Me flags, dressed up as George Washington, and wore red, white, and blue outfits. The name Tea Party itself, of course, referred to the Boston Tea Party, a 1773 act of rebellion against British rule. They took inchoate energy and created a coherent narrative, said Vanessa Williams, co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. The power of the American revolutionary image that they used was really substantial. It gave them a way to talk about their concerns that Barack Obama was un-American. But when the Tea Party revolutionaries arrived in D.C., they were furious that their own Republican leaders could not quickly accomplish the change they demanded. They ultimately forced the Republicans' own House Speaker, John A. Boehner of Ohio, to step down. When we had the original Tea Party in the United States of America, we threw the tea out of the ship. We didn't sink the ship in the harbor, said Representative Austin Scott, Republican from Georgia, who is president of the 2010 House GOP freshman class. The faction that wanted to sink the ship in the harbor, we had a hard time with. I'm all for throwing the tea in the harbor, not for sinking the ship. Trump stepped into that morass of disappointment and thwarted expectations, promising to accomplish by force of will what activists had failed to accomplish within the system. Martin of the Tea Party Patriots said her movement shares what she described as MAGA's embrace of free markets and personal freedoms. Those are the most important things to think of when we think about how the movements are similar and why people who were in the Tea Party movement originally would have floated to the MAGA movement, Martin said. Trump spoke to Tea Party groups when he was first thinking of running for office, Martin said, and Tea Party activists were on his first campaign team. Martin said she supported Trump's sprawling budgetless legislation this year, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, despite its addition to the deficit, in part because she has come to realize that revolutionary changes take time. What we have learned in the past 16 years is that even if you're moving in the right direction, you may not always get everything you want, Martin said. We understand how Congress works now much more than we did before. Part of what we have learned is that when you care about something and want to advance whatever it is, our founding fathers created a system with all sorts of checks and balances, and it makes changes very slow. Tea Party activists routinely vilified and ran against traditional Republican lawmakers in 2010 who made exactly those arguments. Liberal critics charged that the Tea Party was motivated at least in part by racial animus, especially as a backlash against the first black president. Others challenged its claims of grassroots credibility, noting that billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch contributed substantial funds to build up the movement. Similar criticism has been leveled at MAGA, that it is driven by racism and funded by billionaires. Leaders of both movements reject these claims, saying it is shameful to challenge the motives of millions of Americans who have attended their rallies and supported their candidates with the sole aim of building a better country. The diminished plight of today's Tea Party was illustrated last month when Trump pointedly excluded Paul, the Kentucky senator, from a high-profile gathering of Republican senators at the White House to strategize on the government shutdown. For years, Paul has criticized Republican positions on spending under Trump. Today is the final nail in the coffin. The Tea Party is no more, he said in a July 2019 speech on the Senate floor, referring to a spending deal that suspended the debt limit for 2 years. This year, Paul was among the few Republicans to have opposed Trump's marquee budget bill and the recent stopgap spending measure. When he was left out of the recent White House meeting, Paul posted a photo of himself with Representative Thomas Massie, Republican from Kentucky, another veteran of the Tea Party era, who has earned Trump's wrath for defying him in the name of fiscal responsibility and constitutional principles. Paul did not say it, but the photo in some ways reflected how much the Tea Party movement has shrunk since the heady days of 2010. The last time he played golf with Trump was in June, Paul said, right before he voted against the president's spending bill. Asked who won, Paul said, "Now, that is top secret." This article was first published in the Washington Post. On the health and science page, a bird flu threat to Thanksgiving. After a quiet summer, bird flu is back just in time for Thanksgiving. Cases tend to surge in the fall when the migrating geese end and other birds head south. Since early September, nearly 7 million farmed birds have died in new outbreaks, and 1.3 million of them were turkeys. The National Turkey Federation says there will definitely be enough supply for the holiday rush, largely thanks to stockpiles of frozen birds. But wholesale prices are already 40% higher than they were last fall, and they could rise even further for fresh birds if the outbreaks worsen. It doesn't help that this year's surge began earlier than usual, or that it's coinciding with a federal government shutdown that has left disease surveillance severely hampered. Both the USDA and the CDC have suspended their channels of routine communication with the states, leaving farms, veterinary labs, and state health departments with patchy information. But the more the virus spreads in animals, the more likely it is to evolve a way to spread among humans. It has already jumped to dozens of mammal species. Since 2022, at least 70 people in the U.S. have been infected, and one has died. For now, authorities are taking a watch-and-wait approach. "It's an interesting time," Declan Schroeder, a virology professor at the University of Minnesota's College of Veterinary Medicine, tells NBCNews.com. "Everyone is waiting with bated breath to see what's going to happen." Pig kidney lasted months. A man has set a new record by living 271 days with a genetically modified pig kidney. Tim Andrews, 67, received the transplant at Massachusetts General Brigham in January. Suffering from end-stage kidney disease, he'd been undergoing 6 hours of dialysis 3 days a week. Andrews knew the xenotransplant procedure was risky, but thought it was worth it if he could get off dialysis, at least for a little while, and help further the science of transplants. The pig kidney, which came from a genetically edited animal named Wilma, allowed him to return to normal activities, cooking, walking his dog, and on one occasion even throwing the first pitch at Fenway Park. "I was alive, and I hadn't been in a long time," he told CNN earlier this year, describing the transplant as a miracle. He had to have the kidney removed recently after it began to fail, and now he's back on the waiting list. Mass General hailed Andrews, the fourth person in the U.S. to get a pig kidney, as a selfless medical pioneer. And on the Talking Points page, we can probably get two of these articles. Obamacare, why premiums are rocketing. When describing what it was like to discover how much her Affordable Care Act plan would cost next year, Stacey Cox used one word repeatedly, said Justin Gomez in ABCNews.com. Devastating. The Utah-based photographer's monthly health insurance premium will leap from $495 to $2,168. An unmeetable cost, she says, will force her and her husband to go without insurance. Cox, 48, is one of the estimated 22 million ACA enrollees who will see their premiums spike in 2026 by an average of 114%, according to health policy group KFF. That rise is largely due to the December 31st expiration of pandemic-era enhanced premium subsidies, which are at the heart of the government shutdown, with Democrats insisting any funding bill must also extend the tax credits. If those subsidies disappear, the impact will not be felt evenly, said Robert King in Politico. It depends on an enrollee's income, size of household, and where they live. Some states are contributing funds to reduce the impact. That includes Maryland, where the average ACA premium will rise 30%. In New Jersey, it's 175%. The lavish subsidies are a Band-Aid for a broken healthcare system, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Passed as a temporary measure to help families, including those earning more than 400% of the poverty level, who were previously ineligible for subsidies, the credits led ACA enrollment to more than double between 2019 and 2025. That increased the demand for health care, which in turn raised cost. Now the bill is coming due, and Democrats' only plan is to shovel more taxpayer money into a pit of ever larger subsidies. Despite Democratic howling, the real problem isn't the loss of subsidies, said the Wall Street Journal. It's the ACA. Is a debacle delivering plans few deem worth buying unless they're protected from the cost. The GOP should seize this moment to start building lifeboats from Obamacare. Good luck with that, said Jonathan Cohn in the Bulwark. Since the day President Barack Obama signed the ACA into law in 2010, Republicans have assailed the program while promising to provide cheaper, better health care without major coverage losses. But their abject failure to deliver a plan has become a running joke in Washington. And the idea that it will happen now is so fanciful, even GOP Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene has mocked it. That's why, with their own constituents getting sticker shock, a Republican compromise on subsidies may be coming. GOP lawmakers may hate Obamacare, but they know the voters disagree. Trump on the path to autocratic rule. Are we losing our democracy? Asked the New York Times in an editorial. The United States is not an autocracy today, but President Trump and his administration have raised this chilling question with a series of major steps toward one-man rule. Most modern authoritarians, like Hungary's Viktor Orban and Turkey's Recep Tayyip Erdogan, have not seized power in an overnight military coup, but instead by using the power of elected office to steadily erode freedom and the rule of law, intimidate citizens and the national legislature into compliance, defy courts, prosecute enemies, and punish free speech, and make political opposition more difficult, if not impossible. Trump has checked all those boxes. Like many autocrats, he's engaged in blatant corruption, adding billions to his net worth while promoting a bizarre cult of personality. America has started down an anti-democratic path, and we are not yet 1 year into Trump's four-year term. Like other authoritarians, Trump also insists on the right to unilaterally use the military for whatever purpose he chooses, said Jim VandeHei and Mike Allen in Axios. He has declared multiple states of emergency as a pretext to deploy National Guard troops and armed federal agents to the streets of Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and other cities. In the Caribbean, Trump has ordered the military to obliterate boats and kill dozens of people he alleges were smuggling drugs without any evidence or due process. The U.S. has become what scholars call a competitive authoritarian regime, said Christopher Armitage in his Substack newsletter. In countries like Orban's Hungary and Narendra Modi's India, elections take place, opposing parties exist, and courts function, but they all operate on a playing field tilted so severely that true democracy no longer exists. If Americans do not mobilize in massive numbers to halt Trump's power grab, he'll move the country to the next stage, consolidated authoritarianism or true dictatorship. The 2026 midterms will be a pivotal moment, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. To keep Republican control of the House, Trump has promoted extreme redistricting, is attempting to usurp states' constitutional roles in administering elections, and is challenging the integrity of voting machines and mail-in balloting. What is to stop him from sending armed soldiers to intimidate voters and ordering the seizure of fraudulent voting machines and ballots? If he gets away with that, there may not be much democracy left to save in 2028. On the poll watch, we see that 64% of Americans think President Trump is going too far in trying to expand the power of the presidency. 59% disapprove of his job performance, and 62% disapprove of his handling of the economy. 55% of Americans expect an increase of political violence. 24% believe there are some instances where political violence is justified. 41% are afraid to share their political views in public. And after those numbers, maybe we should get a little comic relief from Yogi Berra, quoted in the Santa Cruz, California Good Times, who says, "It's tough to make predictions, especially about the future." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week magazine. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.